But today is VE Day. The war is
over. The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show, where we discuss the key topics shaping the UK wealth management industry and investors' portfolios. I'm Sophie Downes and I'm joined today by Rich Pazina, founder, chairman and co-chief investment officer at Pazina Investment Management. Hello and welcome, Rich.
Good morning.
Why don't we start talking about the kind of origins of Pazina? So you founded the firm over 30 years ago now. What did you set out to do? And I suppose, how has that thesis fared over three decades?
Well, you have to include the personal reasons as well as the professional reasons. And I would say the personal were 80% and the professional 20. It was a dream to start my own firm. It was a dream. What I had been at Sanford Bernstein for 10 years before then and watched as their business grew from $4 billion to $80 billion, and I saw all the things I liked, which were a commitment to research and a systematic process for knowing what's cheap and what's expensive. But I also thought that the way they handled their growth was less than optimal for the clients. And so we vowed when we started that we would never take more assets than you could possibly deploy in the same manner that you've always deployed them, and that the focus on research would never change and never be subsumed by two, like quantitative analysis or risk modeling.
Mm-hmm. And where did that interest in value really stem from?
I mean, again, these are more personal questions because they're people who are either value people or growth people. If you're a natural optimist and you see all the good things in life, you tend to have to gravitate towards growth. If you spend your life searching for bargains, and I grew up in a household where we were never allowed to buy clothes until they went on sale, that mentality is what drives you, and I think I just have that gene.
Mm. I mean, I've met value managers and I think I can kind of see that trend. That's really interesting to hear. What's been the hardest lesson, I suppose, though, being a value investor, through three decades of market extremes?
And in those three decades, by the way, this is our third sort of major technological change that people thought would change the world. And when that happens and they get excited about those technologies, the first one obviously being the internet bubble in 98, 99, early 2000, then I would call it a fintech bubble where we thought the banks were going to go away because we could do everything by phone. And now obviously AI, there are very, very challenging periods. And so the lesson that I've learned over time is that you have to do what you're good at, not what everybody else wants. So there are times when you're out of favor and you have to accept that that's the way it is. But those are the times that give rise to really the best opportunities because everybody's ignoring the things other than what's hot, which now is obviously AI.
Mm. How does, because you mentioned two other instances there. Obviously, the conversation now is obsessive around AI, really. How does this compare to those two examples you gave previously?
Well, there's some real key differences. I mean, real key similarities. But the key similarities are a very big disconnect between what the technology people who get excited about the technology think and what the business people who are the customers of the technology think, because so much of technology's mindset, and really this is what you think of if you're running a technology company, I want to displace the existing technology and because mine's better. And that's the whole reason for existing. But when you're in the frenzy like we are right now, everybody forgets that you have to have customers to buy the technology. And if the whole idea is that you're going to put your customers out of business, it's a bad business strategy. And so in both cases, the executives of companies that would use the technology were extremely excited about the prospects for improving their businesses, while the market saying, I don't even know if you're going to exist. And so far, the last two cycles, the customers actually thrived, strengthened their businesses, and wound up with higher margin structures on the other side of the technological change than they started with. And so I don't know why this will be different, but obviously this is a much, much bigger scale, right? And the whole case for how do you pay for all of this technology is productivity gains, and therefore you have to reduce your headcount to pay for this technology. And we've seen enterprises struggling with that decision. The tech enterprises have all done it already. Mm-hmm. The customers of the tech are trying to figure it out.
And there does seem to be so much fear around AI, as much as, you know, there's so much opportunity and it's exciting. You know, there is that real sense, okay, what is this going to mean for us in the future? But we don't.
That's exactly what we saw in the, really? In the internet bubble. And I'll give you one about the fintech revolution. So I had a very interesting conversation in 2017, something like that, with the CEO of Citigroup, the big U.S. global banking institution. And he was describing 5 years earlier. So he would say 5 years ago in 2012, I had an endless parade of 28-year-old CEOs of startup fintech companies coming into my office telling me they were going to put me out of business. And I was thinking to myself, do they even know what a bank is? I don't think they want to be a bank. And now, which was 2017, now I have a new crop of 28-year-old CEOs of startup fintech companies that are in my office to sell me their technology because they figured out that they're going to make more money if we're stronger, rather than putting us out of business. And that's what it's evolved. Now, you look at the banking, the global big bank sector, who could afford to spend all the money on technology, and they've increased their leadership in terms of market share and increased their margins in terms of the profitability. And so, you know, you can have tech winners and customers of tech being the winners.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean you would approach this AI cycle with perhaps more optimism?
I approach it, first of all, I'm a value investor. So when I see multiple companies with $1 trillion plus valuations on technology that hasn't settled out yet, I mean, it makes you think about back to the internet days. And, you know, the first, I think, I don't remember the years exactly, but in the beginning of when we were getting excited about the internet, like 1998, and everybody thought that the dominant browser, Netscape, would be the one that would be dominant forever, and the dominant search engine, which probably nobody even knows the name of it, AltaVista, was going to be the dominant one forever. And now we have all of these that have multi-trillion-dollar valuations, and they can't all be the winners.
What does this mean then, I suppose, you know, within this cycle where the market is so focused on growth, where are the value opportunities at the moment?
Well, I'll answer that question in 1 minute, but I'll also say that we get asked the question all the time, you know, how do you come into work every morning when nobody likes you? and the reality is that the performance of value investors in the last 10 years is not bad. It's really the same as it's been over a longer period of time. It just doesn't match the performance of the growth stock investors. So it's not that something went wrong in value. It's that something went really right on the other side. So they're different, right? So the things that we're looking at today, first of all, almost everybody would tell you the U.S. is the priciest market in the world. But for cheap stocks, the U.S. is the cheapest market in the world. And that's a big reversal from the last 5 years, where you would say the big bargains are in Europe and emerging markets if you're trying to find cheap stocks. Today, those have rallied, and their valuations have increased, while the cheap stocks in the U.S., they've done fine, but the actual valuations have declined over the last 10 years, making it one of the more interesting places to invest, and smaller caps better than larger caps. Mm-hmm. And then there's sectoral issues, but those are different by market. Like in the United States, and I spend most of my time on the U.S., we're a global firm, but we split. The reason my title is co-chief investment officer is because my co-part of it is the U.S. But in the U.S., healthcare is the biggest sector that we're in. Really not going to be disrupted by AI. They'll be a user of AI. But the issues that healthcare companies are facing have nothing to do with technology. It's not like they're cheap because somebody's going to put them out of business. They're cheap for the reason stocks always get cheap, which is something went wrong in their industry, and they're working on fixing it. And those are the kinds of things that we buy.
Mm-hmm. So it's entirely dependent where, you know, I suppose, region and sector, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, there are some themes that run through the world. Like people are fearful of the consumer health, because there's inflation and that there's a squeeze on the ability of affordability. That's in housing, but it's also in other big ticket items like automobiles. That creates opportunities because we have to live somewhere and we have to get to work. And so the cars can only last so many years before they have to be replaced. And that's those kinds of cases that you see cropping up all over the world are common.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about your US Best Ideas portfolio. So it's highly concentrated. What is the absolute kind of minimum hurdle, I suppose, a stock must clear to make it to that list today?
Well, we use a metric that we'll call price to normal earnings, which is very different than price to current earnings. Because there is no way to look up what normal earnings are. But normal earnings we can define as what should the company earn over a full economic cycle, given its history, given its competitive strengths or weaknesses within the industry, and given the management and its business plan, what's rational for it to earn? And you can start with history, like what has it earned in the past? And that's how we do it. We screen based on, if I didn't know anything about these companies other than how they did in the last 10 years, what would I naively project the next 10 years, the next 5 years to be? We go up 5 years. And rank from cheapest to most expensive. And so what you find is that the companies that are at the top of the list have had some great history. Something has happened and the earnings have fallen off of that long-term norm and the stock price goes down. And the computer doesn't know anything other than the last 10 years was this. So what's at the top of the list are companies that are selling for a low price relative to what their history suggests they should be earning. And they're generally not earning that. So you have a very rich universe to go in and analyze it and say, is this business any good? Are the problems temporary and not permanent? And does the management have a rational plan to restore the earnings? And those are all judgments, and those all go into what we think of as normal earnings. But when you do that systematically, there's always a stream of interesting things that you can invest in, because we've never had a market where everything goes right for every company.
Mm. Has that, you know, your ideal company, has that company profile changed throughout the time you've been running it?
Dramatically. I mean, because it's different industries that get cheaper. I mean, if you think about around the time of the financial crisis, when the banking sector just got annihilated, and you added to that fintech that said, well, we don't need a bank, you could buy bank. Even after the financial crisis was resolved, you could buy banks that were now earning their normal returns of, call it, 12 to 15% a year on their book value for below their book value. So that means that you were earning more than 12 to 15 as an investor in that because you're buying it at a discount. And these are great franchises. You know, J.P. Morgan, from the U.S. perspective, is the best example of this. These were the technology leaders and the business leaders, and you could still get that at or below book value. Mm. Not anymore.
But, not anymore. What's the typical amount of time you hold a company?
Our average holding period's around 3.5 years. So it's not permanent, but it's not a short-term trade either. Because what makes something cheap is that you really don't know what's going to happen in the future. Most people don't buy stocks unless they think they know what's going to happen. But if you think you know, the odds that you are the only one who thinks that are pretty low. So we buy before we know. And when there's a skewing between the upside and the downside, because if they succeed, if the managements do turn the business around, you're buying them, generally speaking, at half the levels they would trade at if things were going well. And if things don't recover, you don't have that much downside risk because the stock market is already reflecting the pessimistic case. So, you know, we try to find things where even if you were 50-50 and your guess you would win, and if you could be 60-40 because of a intense research process, then you can have a great record.
Mm-hmm. So you look for strong management, kind of high barriers to entry, I suppose, and a pricing power in a turnaround.
The problem is every investor you talk to will sum up whether they're a growth investor or a value investor will say exactly the same thing. We buy good businesses for low prices. That's what they all say, right? Now, I've been doing this for 40 years. I've never found a good business that sells at a low price. Okay, so all those things you say, like high barriers to entry, competitive moat, a strong management team, good growth prospects, high margins, clean balance sheet, those don't sell for low prices. So you have a choice as an investor to pay the high price, and you'll sense my charged language, hope that things work out better than everybody else thinks they're going to work out, or you can sacrifice on one or more aspects of quality. But sometimes that quality issue is a temporary problem, right? That's when things get interesting. When something goes wrong in a business that was previously viewed as a quality business, and now nobody wants it anymore, very often the franchise is intact, and they made a mistake, or the industry went in a direction that they didn't anticipate, or there's all kinds of reasons why earnings can fall down. But it's still a good business. And so it has some of those characteristics, but nobody recognizes it at the time, because normally when something goes wrong, they blame the management and they say, well, they're not a good management, right? It's by definition, because they didn't handle this properly.
Mm-hmm. Out of those characteristics then, which, and it's funny because it is the kind of the checklist you hear from every value manager, but out of those characteristics, which is the one that you find most often is maybe the one you're sacrificing on, or
you're sacrificing on the current earnings. That's what you're always sacrificing on, right? Because clearly, if you're trying to get skewed outcomes, meaning that you think this plan is going to work and the downside is limited, it doesn't always work, right? And the whole notion of that, of trying to be selective on what you choose, it really is, if this management fails to restore the business back to normal, is it worth continuing to try, right? So would the board appoint a new management and say, all right, we'll try another plan? Or will the same management try another plan? Or would somebody buy the asset saying, I'll be able to run it better than these people have run it? And if you think that's the case, that's the source of the downside protection. Right, it could be anything. It could be a dominant brand or franchise. It could be a low-cost competitive position. It could be a technology, a dominant market share. I mean, something that says you don't walk away from these businesses even if they're not working correctly now. So the downside protection comes from that. So I can't tell you which one of these things are the – because sometimes it's their competitive cost position. Sometimes it's their dominant franchise. They're different. But consistently, they're either not earning what they used to earn or people are afraid that something bad is going to happen in the future. Those are always the case, and therefore people sell those stocks.
Mm-hmm. I know I want to, you know, we've spoken a little bit about kind of AI, but I feel like it's always brought up when you talk about the future or visions for how, you know, your particular initiatives are going to kind of develop. But I've seen before that you've argued that kind of industry incumbents often benefit more from, you know, big technological shifts like AI in this case, rather than the kind of flashy disruptors. Where are you seeing that play out?
Well, obviously, we saw it play out in the prior cycles. Here, you don't know if it's going to play out. So let's just talk about some of the things that people think are going to be disruptive, and their share prices have reflected that. Software is a good example. The ultimate tech argument is you don't need software at all because I just sit down with Claude and type my query in and I get my answer, and what do I need software for? And I'm paying the software vendors a lot of money to organize my data and report on that data to me. And this is the classic kind of thing that AI will displace.
I mean, we saw the big software sell-off, didn't we?
We did.
Yeah.
We did. And yet some of these, like we've been in touch with we recently bought our first software company in our U.S. portfolios, which is a company called Workday. I don't know if that's a familiar name to you. I don't really know how it's going to play out, right? That's why the stock is down 70%. So it's either going to play out where they retain their franchise and they use AI to lower their costs, which they're going to do, and they become the purveyor of the AI solutions for their customer base. In which case you make a lot of money, or we're going to be wrong, and they're a deteriorating franchise over the next 20 years, but they haven't started deteriorating yet. And if that happens, I don't see that much downside, just because it's priced as if it's a deteriorating franchise.
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, I think we're going to see disruption across the board. One thing I'm really intrigued to get your insight on is almost, we talk to fund selectors, we talk to fund managers, and there's seems to be quite a divided use of AI within the investment process. I mean, Pzena, you know, has a very hands-on approach. How do you differentiate that from the kind of quant-driven strategies that we're and models that we're seeing more and more?
Well, I would say both us as a fundamental value manager and a quantitative value manager both believe that you should have a systematic way for deciding what's cheap and what's expensive. The quantitative managers do it without human intervention, so they're using models and that they've tested over years to say this is cheap. We're using research to do that. This is like a slogan on our website. Value is not a factor. Value is a philosophy. Because value, by definition, you can't not like value. Because value is buying something for less than it's worth. So I don't see how you can make any argument that that doesn't work. The question is, how do you calculate what it's worth? And are we out to lunch because we haven't bought the companies that have high growth rates? Because you need to believe those growth rates are there to justify the valuation. And so a lot of these have momentum aspects to it, a lot of the quantitative models and the AI-based trading, because it works, right? Momentum works. But we think about it, a business, as if we pay the current price to buy the whole business and we're stuck owning it for the rest of our lives, would we want to do it? Is it a good business that's going to give me a life cycle return as opposed to one that's going to give me a good trade over the next year? And it's a very different mentality. AI is very useful for us too, in a different way, not to figure out what stocks to buy from a quantitative perspective, but to make our work lives easier and gathering the information that you need to decide whether it's even worth devoting analyst time to it and making the analyst more efficient. And we're really in the infancy of doing that, but there's lots of opportunities for us that we already see.
Mm-hmm. And do you see your kind of business evolving down that AI trajectory?
Of course. Just like it evolved around the internet trajectory and that we all use all the fintech tools that are available. So using it is not an option. Those are the people who decide not to do it. There won't be any of those because they'll go out of business if that's the decision that they make.
Well, one thing we haven't spoken about and I was very keen to is the kind of leadership side of Pzena and I suppose your future plans. So we actually spoke to Caroline Kai a few weeks ago and we did an interview with her. But what struck me as really interesting about the management is the fact that senior, you know, positions, you often hold multiple roles. Firstly, how does that work in practice?
Well, I mean, it started with me, right? You start an investment business and you believe that you're going to be doing investing. And then all of a sudden, and really that was the case for the first 10 years because there was nothing to do running a business when you're relatively small. But when you start to have some success and you move into global markets and global clients and there's regulatory differences all over the place, it just gets complicated and complicated and complicated. So the multiple role, but now let me give the but on that. In the investment business, you really have two choices for who your leader is going to be, an investment person or a business person. And I think you get very different enterprises if you have one or the other. Like the way a business person approaches the investment business is, let's look at the market, see where the demand is, and provide a product to meet that demand. And you have all these giant asset management supermarkets that do all that. We have a very different approach, which is we only know how to do one thing. And so we better make sure that that's the only thing we focus on. And so putting an investment person in the leadership role elevates the investment team in the organization, but it also makes it difficult to stray from your basic investing philosophy. And that straying, and I watched it during the internet bubble, I watched value people start to invest in tech because they didn't want to go out of business. And then when it reversed, they went out of business anyway because people were expecting them to be value and they didn't do what a value manager was supposed to do when the bubble collapsed. So the dual roles are really important. It's how you build the culture of an organization. It's also how the CEO will be in touch with clients and understand what's on the client's mind, and that makes them a better leader. Because you have both the insiders and the outsider perspective on your business. So you just can't let it get out of control. The last 15 years for me included building all the systems that we needed, the support in terms of compliance and financial and operational that you have to have as a business. That now is professional and has leaders. And so Caroline can focus on really just strategy and then also the investment team. So I happen to think that's the only way to do it for our kind of organization.
I mean, I was going to ask you, you know, how do you ensure the business continues past its founders? But it seems like that leadership and, you know, having those dual responsibilities, knowing all the different, you know, parts of how a business would work seems to be quite a large proponent of that.
Yeah. And I'd also say that being very thoughtful about how you do the transition is part of it. I mean, I told Caroline at her first review 20 years ago that she was going to be the next chief investment officer of the company. Mm-hmm. And she was probably still in her 20s, maybe a little bit older. I don't remember. But you just know these things, right? When you work with somebody and you get – there aren't that many really, really gifted investment people. So it was an easy choice for us as to who would lead the transition. But it wasn't an easy choice for her. Right? So this was, believe it or not, 10 years in the making. That was thoughtful. She joined our executive committee. She did it. She was very quiet for the first 6 months. Then she started talking. Then she started leading. So it like almost happened without making a formal announcement.
I mean, a final question. I can imagine after pouring so much of your time and energy and focus into a company for the last three decades, do you ever really step away?
I do. I mean, because the part of it that is dealing with people and dealing with administrative details isn't that much fun. So my stepping away, it's not really stepping away. Mm-hmm. It's stepping away because I don't have anybody reporting to me anymore. Mm-hmm. But it's not stepping away from the investment side. So I'm in my element right now. I just get to hang out with the investment team, smart people, work with young analysts and trying to make them better investors and challenge the senior portfolio managers to make the right decisions. And that's kind of my role. Now I will do that until they throw me out. And I've told them they should throw me out when I'm no longer of value.
Right. I think that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Rich. And we'll see you next time.
Today is VE Day. The boys
are the crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.